Good afternoon, everyone. Did you all have a nice Thanksgiving? We were in Los Angeles with my son, and during the course of the meal, I asked my sister-in-law a question. If she was the type of person that liked to go to the end of a book and read the last two pages so she knew what was going to happen. And she said, well, if I think it's marginal, I may do that. But for the most part, she preferred, and I feel the same way, to start at the beginning, go all the way through, and not miss out on the suspense, the anticipation of what is going to happen. And it seemed like you're cheating yourself a little if you do that. Does anyone in here read the last two pages of a novel or a mystery? Oh, so a few of you do. So anyway, I'm going to violate my own principle today. I'm going to have you turn to Genesis 45, verse 5, and let you read the last part of a story. It's not the last part of the life of the person, but it is the last part of a segment of his life. And this is where is it working? Is it working? Okay. Because I don't know if I can shout that loud. In any event, you know the story well, but in Genesis 45, verse 5, Joseph said, "Don't be grieved or angry with yourselves for that you sold me hither, because it was God that sent me here to preserve life." And he was telling him that everything that he went through led up to this one part of his life. And this was the important facet of it. I'm going to go back and look at a part of this his life, beginning at age 17, where this all started, and try and understand why it happened the way it did. Did it have to happen the way it did? I think we can probably see some logical reasons for it. You don't have to turn to any other scriptures. I'm just going to kind of paraphrase the story for you, and you probably know it pretty well. But in Genesis 7 or 37, this is where Jacob gives his son a new Brooks Brothers suit. And of course, this makes his brothers very mad. And they even get madder when Joseph opens his mouth and starts telling him about his dreams. And so they conspire to kill him first, but then Judah gets a little greedy, true to his heritage, and decides to sell him for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites, who take him down into Egypt and sell him to Potiphar, the captain of the guard and the chief executioner, a very responsible position. And of course, to cover up their crime, they take the blood of a goat, smear it on the coat, send it back to their father. Now, if CSI was around at that time, they could have analyzed the blood and told him that it was the blood of a Nubian goat, and he didn't have to worry. It wasn't human blood. But they weren't there. And so for the next 22 or 23 years, until he was reunited with Joseph, he had this terrible, searing, agonizing pain, excruciating pain, this sense of loss, because he'd never seen a body. He didn't know. He didn't have any closure. He didn't know if his son was alive or dead. He was being exploited someplace. He was a slave. I had a dog when I was in grade school. He was called Tippy Spotty, a little black and white mongrel with a short, stubby tail. And one day he disappeared. And I remember walking up both sides of the road, seeing if I could find a body, see if I could discover what had happened to him. But I never did. I don't know to this day if an animal got him, a coyote or a cougar, if someone stole him, although I don't know what they'd want with an old mongrel like him. But I can remember that sense of loss. And every night when I'd get off the school bus, my other dog, Mickey, would come running out, and I'd be looking for Tippy Spotty, hoping that he'd show up. Or when I went out to the barn to milk the cows, and I'd take my pail out and check the milk dish where the cats and dogs would huddle around to be fed. But he never was there. But I remember how much that affected me. For years, literally, that was just a dog. Can you imagine what it's like to lose a child and have the child disappear and not see a body, not knowing, well, the child died? Now, why did this happen to Jacob? I don't know. Perhaps it was for stealing his brother's birthright, his brother's blessing. I mean, that's logically the only thing that I can think of, but there's nothing really there to say. And here was a man that walked with God, and yet, in spite of the fact he'd wrestled with him, he had a great affinity for him, God allowed Jacob to go through this as well. But this isn't about Jacob, this is about Joseph. So he gets to Egypt, jumps off the camel, walks into Potiphar's house, and Potiphar immediately says, "Hey, you look like you could run my house. So here it is, take over." I don't think it happened quite that way. I think he recognized that Joseph had talent, and probably over a period of months and years, he gradually gave him more and more responsibilities. So until at one point he was running the house. Of course, this caught the eye of Potiphar's wife. They say that there's nothing quite like like an aphrodisiac for a man of power. Now, this Joseph was good looking as well, and so she tried to seduce him unsuccessfully. But finally one day, and I don't know if it was a lapse of judgment on his part or maybe just a mistake or he'd forgotten, he had to go to the bathroom. Maybe he had to go really bad, and so he ran in the house not thinking there isn't anyone else around. And this time his coat got him in trouble again because she grabbed his coat in one last unsuccessful attempt to seduce him. But he got away. But now she had hard evidence, and so when Potiphar showed up, "Look at what your Hebrew servant tried to do to me, tried to sexually assault me." And although Potiphar really liked Joseph, he had no recourse but to put him in prison. Now it said that the Lord was with Joseph while he was in Potiphar's house, and once again he was with him, it said, while he was in prison. And you know the story. Pretty soon he was running the prison. You know, the warden, and maybe Potiphar even gave him a recommendation. Maybe he realized his wife had perjured herself. I don't know. But soon he was running the prison. And you know the story of the baker and the butler, and how 2 years after the butler's restored, he finally remembers Joseph when Pharaoh has a dream. So they summon Joseph hastily. If you read the story, it tells that Joseph took the time to shave himself and change his raiment. What's the importance of something like that? Well, he'd been hanging out with the royalty for the past 13 years. From age 17, it was age 30 when he appeared before Pharaoh. He'd been around royalty, the royal prisoners in the prison. Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. So he knew the protocol. He knew the way he should conduct himself. He knew the way to act. He was an accomplished manager and an executive administrator. So when Pharaoh finally talked to him, and when he received Joseph's recommendations as to what to do to save Egypt, there was no doubt as to who should carry that out. Here was the person right before him. He was dressed appropriately. He knew the right answers. And I guess the thing to think about is, what if Joseph had showed up on the doorstep in front of Pharaoh's house 13 years from age 17 to age 30 after being a shepherd, being out with his brothers, tending the flocks and so forth? I mean, God could have made it happen. He could have directed him there. And he could have put it in Pharaoh's mind that, you know, he interpreted your dream, therefore he should be the one that you put in charge. But it didn't happen that way. Joseph went through experiences that actually prepared him for the huge job that he had. And then 9 years go by, the 7 years of plenty, 2 years into the famine, the brothers come, he plays with them on several occasions, retains Simeon, forces them to bring Benjamin up. And so they're going through a lot of emotional turmoil. Now, why does he do that? I mean, he'd been absent now. He's almost age 40, almost 22 or 23 years. You know, the normal tendency, you'd think, you know, put your arms around them, identify them. Well, I think maybe there's a little bit of human nature at work here. He was kind of making those brothers perhaps wince a little and paying him back a little for what he did. I don't know. There's nothing really to say. But if you think about it, why did it happen the way it did? But any event, it did. And then we come to this part of the story that I just read, where he says, it was God that led me through all of this, all of the things that I went through to bring me here today, to this point in time, to save you, to save a great nation. What kind of similarities are there between what happened to him and our walk through life as Christians? Sometimes if we analyze our lives and we look at what's happening, it seems like maybe there's not a lot of rhyme or reason. It's kind of a circuitous, serendipitous path. We go here and we go there and we have this happen to us, and then we have that happen to us, and we try to make some sense out of it. You know, like Joseph, people are envious of us. People are jealous of us. That happens. Like Joseph, sometimes you hear people say, oh, it's the pits. I feel like I'm in the pits. Has anyone ever heard that expression? Well, of course. And that's describing what Joseph was in, a literal pit. Sometimes we're being seduced, maybe not by a person, but the world out there and the material things out there and everything the world has to offer us is doing a very able job of seduction. Maybe it's subtle, but nonetheless, it's out there. And sometimes some few of us have actually been in prison and have suffered, and we know what that's like. But many of us are prisoners of our negative thoughts, and the things that go on in our mind imprison us and keep us immobile. So we go through, in similar fashion, much the same things, maybe not in an identical way, that Joseph went through. And why? Why has all this happened? Because just like Joseph was prepared to lead a nation, to take on that enormous responsibility, we are similarly being prepared. We're being prepared to help ourselves now, to solve our own problems. We're being prepared, and once we are capable of solving our own problems, we can help others around us, in our families, in our church families, our friends, our neighbors, co-workers at work. I mean, it's all working to train us for greater responsibility. And so someday, in the future, there may be multiple hundreds and thousands and untold numbers of people that will benefit from our lives today and will be able to help in the world tomorrow.